My guest this week is author of a new book about cooperation called Together, The Rituals, Pleasures and Politics of Cooperation. Richard Sennett is one of the leading sociologists of our time. I last spoke to him in 2006 about his book, The Culture of the New Capitalism. Richard Sennett, you're welcome.
Thank you.
A key argument of yours in your book Together is that living with people who differ from us ethnically, religiously, or in terms of wealth, isn't easy. You're saying that cooperation demands skill.
Yes, I mean, it's something we're born with. You know, babies have to cooperate with their parents in order to survive. But as we mature, we can't draw on that kind of infantile experience. We've got to learn how to cooperate with, you know, people we don't understand, we don't like, or we don't know. And what I'm trying to do in this book, rather than make an abstract argument, is to show what those skills are about, what it means to listen well to somebody when they're not very coherent, as I'm not, and get their meaning, even when the words sometimes don't make sense, how to deal with aggression, dealing with other people. I'm interested in a sort of practical side of these difficult forms of cooperation.
Sometimes you feel don't quite do the trick that we often use instead of cooperation, like a term like solidarity, for example. You're saying we that doesn't quite do it for you.
It doesn't. I mean, solidarity is, you know, about being on the same page, unity. A lot of the kinds of agreements or the ways we get along with other people don't involve feeling on the same page with them, feeling solidarity. So in the book, I make a contrast between cooperation and solidarity. And there's a political side to that as well. Solidarity implies a certain kind of discipline. It's a kind of top-down word. It means that everybody hews to the same standard. And lots of forms of complex cooperation are, on the contrary, they're bottom-up. They're what people do in a community meeting, maybe very fractious with each other. A union meeting, people may be very much opposed to other people's views, but by fighting things out face-to-face, they find a way to move forward without feeling that they're all alike. And that kind of bottom-up process seems to me both important and missing in a lot of modern politics, particularly on the left. You know, we made a shrine of solidarity, the workers united and so on. And I think that's done us a lot of harm. It's narrowed the field for political action. Can I say something about the afterlife of this book to you? You know, I finished this book the week before the Occupy movements began. And I also finished it the month before the last round of the European debt crisis took hold in Greece. And I wish I had been a more tardy author.
That's something you can't control, though, isn't it? I mean, really.
No, it's just,
as a programmer, I can tell you, we all have to live with that, yeah.
Yeah. But the Occupy movements, which was very much a bottom-up kind of movement, was something that in bodies is kind of cooperation. Lots of different kinds of people involved in it. What they agreed on were cliches. The real point about it was that you got a lot of different people together.
And they kept making the point, didn't they, Richard, that they had no leaders.
Exactly. The whole point of it was to build something that was cooperative rather than, driven like a political movement. The crisis in Greece dramatized something much more stark, that is in my book, but I should have made more of it, which is another one of these difficult kinds of cooperation, is how the strong and the weak cooperate with each other. And if you look at German behavior the last couple of years, they haven't got a clue. They know that if they don't work with the Greeks, or now with the Spanish and with the Italians, that ultimately they'll be in danger. But their actual behavior at the negotiating table is, it's all your fault, we're more virtuous, do what we say or you can't have the money.
Well, there's also something... something,
it's a kind of humiliation ritual.
Yeah, but there is also...
Even though they know that's very bad, it's a very bad in the long run.
But there is also something, isn't there, in German psychology, a kind of love of deferral, a sense of postponing what maybe deep down they feel needs to be done until the very last moment.
You think that's German psychology? I think that's pretty human. I mean, I...
Touché.
I mean, I had the feeling more with the same feeling I have with Christine Lagarde, you know, her famous thing about you pay your taxes. It's their power that breeds a sense of entitlement. And the entitlement breeds an inability to work with people, even though you know in the long run you can't simply impose your will on them, that there has to be some response. So, you know, I wish both of those things had been
around. Yeah. I just want to ask you this, Richard, that in talking about the need to strike a balance between competition and cooperation in the world we live in is extremely difficult, isn't it, that the culture itself is heavily geared towards competition?
Well, towards unalloyed competition. Mm. I mean, one of the interesting things about cooperation and competition is that they're not really opposites. If you think about what happens to young children about the age of 5 or 6, when they start being able to play games where they set the rules, young children with their competitors agree on a set of terms, and they become very sensitive to cheating, to what psychologists call procedural justice. So you're cooperating to set these rules in order to then compete. And, you know, competition isn't, you know, simply a Darwinian red tooth and claw kind of experience. If it were, we wouldn't have sports. We wouldn't have a lot of markets.
Yes, there's a role, in other words, for a meaningful set of rules. One thing
you
strikes,
have to have it.
Yeah, one thing strikes me is that, interesting in our time, is that when you go to a really global level, you are then talking about cooperation as a sine qua non if we're to survive. It isn't as if it's an option. You know, I'm thinking either at a fiscal level or whatever, that without cooperation we die.
Yes, that's true. I mean, I think what's happened in terms of neoliberal capitalism is that cooperation in the form of connivance is something that's become quite strong among elites, but that cooperation from the top to lower down has become scarcer and scarcer. That's become more red tooth and claw kind of survive if you can, screw your mates, you're on this on your own. And one of the things that I think is sort of involved in critique of neocapitalism is that it's made cooperation a scarcity good. And that's what I argue in the book. And the result of that is to make a lot of business institutions dysfunctional. When there are low levels of cooperation in a business or in a government office, you know, trust goes by the board. Authority is just legitimate authority becomes kind of sham. You know, people get to be in a much more brutalized condition. And in my view, what's happened in the last 20 years, a replacement of what we used to call social capitalism by neoliberalism, has meant that as cooperation of a hierarchical sort has declined, that more and more in these organizations, people in the bottom are forced into a kind of bitter individualism. And that's what I try to explore in my book.
That but that world we've been living in since roughly 1980 or thereabouts, is that here to stay as you see it?
Well, that's a really interesting question. In my crystal ball, which is always cloudy, I would say that we're just at the beginning of seeing this system come apart. Mm. You know, we use the word crisis as though somehow that this is a, you know, serious but temporary glitch that can be fixed.
Well, let me ask you this.
I don't believe that's the case.
What will do in the end for social welfare capitalism? What will do for it?
Well, there are lots of ways to do for it. I mean, and there are lots of models where it works very well. Scandinavian countries are pretty good at it. I think countries like Brazil are beginning to experiment, even Argentina, Britain's least favorite country at the moment, are beginning to experiment with new ways of creating.
But the Anglo-Saxon world.
In the Anglo-Saxon world, I think we have to really look north, and maybe for Britain, to look back to a kind of post-war version of social welfare that, you know, put British society back together in the 50s. I don't think that should be nostalgic. I just think the notion that capitalism has got to be balanced by, you know, both social responsibility but also by social practices is something that, you know, is a necessity. The Germans internally have a very viable social capitalism.
And so had the Japanese.
Yes. I don't know too much about it, but I imagine that's true. But the Germans have, and it's made Germany a very robust economy. And I guess the reason I insist on this is that oftentimes when people talk about cooperation, they say, oh, well, that's nice, so idealistic. It's not very practical, you know. And in fact, when you look at societies like Scandinavian societies or Germany, what you see are very robust societies because people can work together. And I think in the Anglo-Saxon world, I don't know about Ireland, but certainly in Britain, we've lost that. It doesn't really move us. And the same thing is true in the U.S. Very difficult to get people to cooperate with each other.
In your book,
that weakens people.
You make a lot of modes of listening. The one you call dialectical and the other dialogical. Dialectical, I can see, and it's much clearer in the sense of you're working towards a consensus of some kind. What's going on when you're listening or working dialogically?
Well, this is a term derived from a Russian writer, Mikhail Bakhtin. Mm-hmm. And his notion was that the course of people's exchanges with each other in free speech is never very organized or shapely. We sort of bounce off of each other. And the reason we do that is that oftentimes the language that we have at our command isn't equal to what we mean. And I've taken that idea and tried to show how that actually operates. He was a literary critic. I'm a sociologist. Mm-hmm. And to show how that works in everyday life, that listening skills involve intuiting what people mean and the techniques for understanding what they can't put into words and staying with them rather than quitting because there isn't clarity. Which, if you think in a dialectical way, you know, if you can't reach consensus, you leave, you part. But in the real world, I mean, think about in dealings with people we love or with people in community, we don't abandon people just because they're unclear.
Yes, well, we and, can at that point make clever use, can't we, of what's usually referred to as constructive ambiguity. Ambiguity is no bad thing, you would say, no.
Not at all. As a matter of fact, I think that what ambiguity opens up is a space for exchange. If I were able to perfectly summarize for you in five brilliantly clear sentences exactly what my book is about, you and I have no more need to talk. It's over. You know, it's this perfectly formed object. And that's true of lots of social behavior. The ambiguity issues an invitation to the other person to stay connected. To do that, as I point out in the book, you've got to learn how to tolerate a certain amount of frustration. You've got to be focused not on what you think, but what on the other person says in its relation to what other people are trying to think or feel. And it's in, above all, it's informal, right? That the world, the ambiguous world is, or the realm of ambiguity is a realm of informality. And informal social relations are much stronger bonds, stronger networks than highly formalized.
And often the informal ones are the really powerful ones, aren't they?
Absolutely.
In any organization, that is the case.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. The water cooler to talk is the real talk.
Or the director general may not be the most powerful person in the organization. I mean, often it's at an informal level. Can I just ask you something that seems to run counter to the notion of, you know, the dialogical welcoming ambiguity, is the fact that the sciences, you would argue, welcome the dialogic conversation.
Well, you could look at what scientific work is about as resolving ambiguity, as problem solving. But very few good scientists look at it that way. That is, they're involved in asking questions about why, in relating problem solving to problem finding. Mm-hmm. And it's a basic element of curiosity.
I noticed, by the way, you make that distinction between problem solving and problem finding. Jerome Bruner is the only other person I've seen make it. But you do make it more than once.
I emphasize it because, just step back from this book for a second. This book is part of a trio of books I'm writing about skills. And the first book, which is a book about craftsmanship, looks in some more detail at how this kind of scientific dialogue between problem solving and problem finding exists in the laboratory, and how it's that kind of questioning that, rather than simply confirming a hypothesis, which marks good science. I'd say the same thing is true in social relations as in scientific research. That as you get to know somebody, what you don't arrive at is certainty. You get to know more about them. Some things get resolved, but they open up new questions about the other person, the other social group, and so on. And so in the scheme of things, in this big magnum opus, which may see me into the grave, that I'm writing, this notion of a kind of dialogue between arriving at a result and discovering it opens up new problems is, to me, a fundamental aspect of the impulse to know and to make things for human beings.
It's an ongoing procedure, an ongoing process.
It's an ongoing process.
Yeah. One of the most stimulating parts of your book is where you talk about how the Reformation transform cooperation. Just briefly, what happened at that point?
Well, it's quite interesting. Up to the Reformation, the notion of cooperating with each other people in Catholicism, also in Judaism for that matter, was seen to be a ritual where you didn't have any choice. You know, you had to observe the ritual, and it wasn't a matter of your will or your desire, but a a matter of what was required of you, that it was an obligation. What happens in the Protestant Reformation was that people for the first time thought that they could choose or not choose to cooperate as an ethical statement. Both Luther and Calvin, very interesting about this, that under some conditions, the Christian believer can choose to abandon his or her fellows to their own fate.
Mm-hmm.
And in other conditions, he must reach out to them and work with them. That's the notion that you can choose to abandon other people because your own soul has got more urgent work. Very Protestant idea. And it comes down to us in the notion that cooperation is a moral choice rather than, as in older forms of Catholicism or Judaism, an obligation. And I think that it sort of sets the stage for the problem of the ethics of cooperation.
But I take it from all of that, you would not be happy stating quite simply that Catholicism equals cooperation, Protestantism equals fending alone.
No, hardly.
Yep.
No, it's a question of whether this is a matter of religious obligation or not. And this, I have to say, is a Catholicism before Luther. After the Counter-Reformation mm-hmm. sets in...
This would be the early 16th century,
Yeah. Then something else, you know, church power becomes more important than ever. And that also has a numbing effect on cooperation in Catholic churches.
You talk in that context of the move from ritual to spectacle, by which you mean what?
Well, what I mean by that is that cooperative acts become a kind of performance, you know? You're just showing how... They can become that, rather. You're showing how good you are, you know?
Yeah.
The bourgeois visitor to a poor part of a city who performs a good work as a kind of demonstration of what a good person he or she is. And that's kind of degradation of cooperation by making it kind of spectacle to others.
And a corollary of that is that the person looking on is cast in a more subservient role.
Right, or humiliated.
Mm.
Not good.
Yeah, but that's what happens.
Being medieval Catholics.
Yes, but politicians, you would argue, learned that. Of course they did.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's the danger, isn't it, that you get these kind of moral demonstrations by politicians which become humiliating to others. I mean, we have that now in British politics to the nth degree. We have a prime minister who is constantly drawing moral lessons for us about how we should behave, which is very kind of him. And the result of that is to enrage people. And it's class-bound behavior. It's, you know, the elite thinking they can preach to the masses. But the actual transactions are extraordinary. They are simply all exemplary spectacles of what you should be doing, of how you should behave. And I've watched crowds of people respond to both Cameron and Osborne. It's just a feeling like, you know, where are these people coming from? You know, and they alienate people from responding, let's work on this together. But
yes,
Britain
but there are politicians, of course, who have applied that in more sinister fashion, yeah.
Well, yes, of course, Hitler, you think of that. But, I mean, that's an extreme that I don't think is helpful for us understanding what we face about cooperation today, which is that in order to avoid, let's say, the kind of Cameron follow my example sort of social discourse, what we need to do is feel confident that we can build up from below something where we have social bonds and social networks where other people are not examples to us, but in which we're mutually interacting in a very ambiguous process, so that we can create a kind of social tissue between ourselves. And that's a challenge to us. It's particularly a challenge for people on the left who have their own version of top-down, follow-my-example politics. Tony Blair, in Britain, a great example of that, too. But what I've argued for in the book is that the left, to do this, has to be less concerned with party politics and more concerned with different kinds of relationship-building activities. I'm a big fan of perverting Facebook and Twitter to communal purposes and rejecting all the commercial uses of them. But, you know, to making online relations with strangers, I think that's a very exciting possibility for the left. I'd like to see much more interaction between communities of people who are different by class or ethnicity or religion, which means thinking about the city in a different way, about its edges as a place for building up cooperation rather than the centers of communities. There are lots of things we could do. We can also think about labor unions as a kind of new site for community. They're neither intimate. They can be built bottom-up rather than top-down. Lots of things we can do to create a more cooperative society which has a leftist tinge.
Richard Sennett, thank you very much indeed.